So thank you. Thank you for reading that aloud. It's good to use our voices as well as our minds when we approach these old texts. And this text, just to remind you, comes from the 9th century Chinese Zen master Dongshan. But it wasn't written down, or at least the earliest extant copy was not made until several hundred years after his death. So we're not 100% sure he wrote it, but much of the tradition suggests that he did, and that it was passed down orally from teacher to student for generations. It's certainly not an easily accessible text, as you can tell from reading it. But I think with a little decoding, we can begin to enter into Dongshan's world and see that it's not so different from our own more than a millennium later. There are some ways that our human life is much as it was in those days. For those of you who were here from the beginning, or have at least the second or third time dipping into this text, is it starting to open up a little for you? Not quite as obscure as the first time through? Yeah, good. So just to review a little bit before we pick up where we left off last week, the jewel mirror in the title, we could say, is Buddha nature, our true nature, our nature when we're not bound by the conditioning of our karmic lives, our true nature when the mind is unobscured by greed, aversion, and delusion. What are called the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. When the mind is clear of those obstructions, that's samadhi. And when we see with our dharma eye, in that state, we see Buddha nature all around us, in each other, in all beings, sentient beings, insentient beings, as our own reflection. None other than our own reflection. So that's the jewel mirror samadhi. And in this poem, he uses very figurative language in various ways to allude to what in Buddhist thought are called the two truths: the realm of the absolute, the universal, the undifferentiated, which is often referred to as darkness, because in the darkness, everything merges. You can't see differences, right? And the realm of the relative, our everyday lives, where we see distinctions. There's you and me, there's the floor and the ceiling, and that's often referred to as the light, because in the light we can see differences. Yet, those two realms, those two truths, are not separate. They're simultaneous, they coexist. In the darkness, the distinctions are still there, and in the light, everything is still always, always interconnected throughout space and time. So Dongshan's message in this poem is that when we see deeply into this reality, this simultaneous reality, that seeing that is what's called tatata, or thusness in English. It's a tricky word, and in English it's been translated as thusness or suchness. Being fully present to our moment-to-moment existence. Just this reality, both particular and universal, which we do in Zazen, in sitting, standing, walking, and in our daily lives. In any moment, we can awaken to that reality. And in that moment of awakening, we are freed from suffering. So last week, Michael went over a series of verses where Dongshan kept describing it over and over again. Remember, it says, it is this or it is that. And he uses descriptive language describing it. Thusness, the jewel mirror samadhi. So let's pick up where we left off last week. And that is at verse 12 that begins respecting. This is fortunate. Some of you have numbers and some of you don't. Respecting, this is, well, let's see, in the chant book, it's on the page 11 in the chant book. About almost a third of the way down. Respecting, this is fortunate. Could someone read those four lines, please? Yeah, Louise?
Respecting, this is fortunate. Do not neglect it. Naturally real, yet inconceivable. It is not within the province of delusion or enlightenment.
So here's, he's pausing. He's just given us a whole list of descriptions. And now he's pausing to remind us that this realization is precious. We should respect it and maintain it. We can't grab it and keep it. You know, sometimes we have moments of deep opening or a flicker of experiencing this true reality, and then it's gone. You know, we relapse into our daily habit patterns, and it can be frustrating when that happens. Oh, you know, here I go again. But that's natural. That's absolutely natural, and we have to fold that right into our practice. Just this is it. Just this is it. Even when just this is me having a hissy fit again about something that is minor. Sometimes just this is it is our human lives, just as they are in this moment. So this admonition to respect it and maintain it reminds me of the words of Dongshan's teacher, Yunyan. I mentioned the 2 weeks ago in my first talk, when Dongshan was leaving his teacher to travel on and travel to other monasteries and other teachers. And he asked his teacher, what should I say when people ask me to sum up your teaching? And Yunyan said, just this is it. And then he paused and said, you are now in charge of this great matter. You must be thoroughgoing. You know, so you must keep practicing. So this is a little pause in the poem where he's saying, respect and maintain this practice. And then he continues. He goes on to describe the paradoxical nature of this jewel mirror samadhi. Further, he says, naturally real yet inconceivable, it is not within the province of delusion or enlightenment. So thusness, just this, is simply natural and at the same time awesome. And it's beyond the duality of delusion and enlightenment. It's not a matter of striving after to get an enlightenment experience or about vanquishing delusion. It's about just this right now. So in our steady practice over time, we integrate the experience of the absolute or the universal with its everyday expression in the phenomenal world, in our everyday world. They're not separate. Could somebody read the next verse, please? Actually, could you read? So starting with causal conditions. Oh, I can't find, okay. Yeah, with causal conditions, and continue right down to a hair's breadth deviation. So the next three pairs of lines. Could someone read those? Ben, could you read them?
With causal conditions, time and season, quiescently it shines bright. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. A hair's breadth's deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement.
So here he's saying that through continuously changing conditions, this light of awareness shines and illuminates our lives just as they are, boundless, through space and time in each moment. And more vast than we can perceive or comprehend. There's a passage from Dogen, who in the 13th century brought this Zen tradition from China to Japan, in a writing of his called Genjo Koan. Some of you will be familiar with these lines. Genjo Koan is usually translated as actualizing the fundamental point. But I kind of like to think of it as the fundamental question of our lives, the fundamental koan of our lives. So here's the quote. When you sail out in a boat to the midst of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular. I've never been out of sight of land in the ocean. Have any of you been in the open ocean? Yeah. So you know what that looks like. He says, but the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It's like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this, though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions. You see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is not so only around you, but also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water. So I love this passage. You know, it's saying that there are whole worlds beyond human perception, right? In the soil, beneath our feet, in a drop of pond water, if you've ever looked in through a microscope, and then through a telescope out into the galaxies beyond where our sight can reach. You know, even if we could look through the eyes of a bee or a dragonfly, the world would look so different. Can't even imagine what it would look like, what we could see. And it's the same living in our conditioned human lives. We can only see as far as our eye of practice can reach. But when our eye of practice opens up wider, we can see wider. We can see Buddha nature in each other and everything around us, instead of, you know, me against the world. And a hair's breadth deviation. As soon as we're hanging on to some sort of fixed view or an attraction or an aversion, already we're out of alignment, we're out of tune. Already we're stuck in the past or in anticipation of the future. And we're missing the full scope of that moment in our lives. Okay, could someone continue with the next set of three, not rather than set of... So now there are sudden and gradual. Maybe, Brian, could you read those?
Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. Once basic approaches are distinguished, then there are guiding rules.
And the next.
But even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah. So here he's referring to what have been probably stereotyped as the sudden and gradual schools of Zen. One emphasizing achieving a kind of sudden, dramatic awakening or enlightenment experience, and the other emphasizing more of a gradual cultivation of practice. One, a kind of breakthrough experience with the conditioned mind dropping away. And the other, a gradual polishing, likened to sort of wiping dust from a mirror sometimes. The other analogy often used is a gradual penetration of a kind of West Coast drizzle. You don't really realize you're getting wet. And then, you know, gradually it soaks in. And the Dharma, the expanded view, soaks in without you really realizing it. I kind of like that analogy, the West Coast drizzle. So the sudden and the gradual. He's saying that these basic approaches are developed, you know, in the course of, you know, the history of Zen and Buddhist practice. And methods, there may be methods that are taught that are skillful and helpful. But ultimately, he says, true eternity still flows. So those distinctions, the sudden and gradual, merge in the jewel mirror samadhi. How could awakening be anything but sudden? Boundlessly present in a moment, one moment. And how could it be anything but gradual? Maintained, refined, integrated over years of living in the world. Sometimes those arguments over sudden and gradual, to me, seem like when I was taking psychology, and there was the cognitive camp and the psychodynamic camp, and the, you know, and each theorist laid claim to his territory, you know, this is how the mind is. And each one, to me, just seemed limited. No one encompassed the whole wonder of our body-mind. So I would get kind of impatient with them. And sometimes the sudden and gradual camps of Zen have that same effect on me. Because, of course, it's both. So, could someone read the next two pairs, next four lines? Yeah, please.
Two pairs? Mm-hmm. Outwardly still while inwardly moving, like a tethered cold, trapped rat. The ancient sages pitied them and bestowed upon them the teaching.
Thank you. That's good, yeah. So a terrified colt, a trapped rat, frozen, right, unable to move, but inside trembling, the heart pounding. Sometimes we feel like that in life. We can't fight or flee, so we freeze, right? Sometimes we feel like that sitting zazen. Can we possibly sit still until the bell rings? Can the person sitting so still beside me tell what a mess I am inside? isn't this really how so many people go through life, putting on a brave face, you know, or a cheery face, never letting, or a competent face, or a smart face, clever face, not letting on how vulnerable they feel inside. Now, some of us tend to, we tend to have a, you know, an MO. Some of us tend to go into fight mode habitually. Some of us tend to go into flight mode. Let me out of here. I don't want to deal with this. And some of us freeze, like the tethered colt. But each of those reactions, and those are typical reactions to threat, right? They're natural. They're hardwired in us. But they're all based on our belief in me against the world, you know, the separate self. And of course they're based on, you know, some basic survival necessities. But most of the time when we are firing up those threat hormones, our lives are not in danger. What's in danger is our attachment to a belief or an identity or a person or something that we're hanging on to. But fortunately, the ancient sages have taken pity on us and taught us this practice, another way to be present with the suffering that we habitually create in our lives, by operating in threat mode so much of the time. They taught us to sit upright in this dignified posture, not with gritted teeth. Can I make it till the bell rings? But with a spacious, non-judgmental awareness of our moment-to-moment experience, seeing whatever arises as due to causes and conditions and subject to change. When we see that, we can be less identified with the content that arises in our mind, less driven by it. So it gives us a little space, a little freedom to be free, to respond to the world appropriately in each moment, you know, with wisdom and compassion. It's not like we disengage completely from the world, but we have a flexibility and a spontaneity and an openness, ability to respond. The jewel mirror samadhi is so minute it can penetrate the finest cracks in our armored selves, the shells we create around ourselves, and it's so vast that nothing is excluded. No part of our life is excluded. There's a lovely poem by the great 10th century Japanese woman poet Izumi Shikibu. She wrote, "Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Okay, could someone read the next three pairs of lines, according to their delusions? Yeah, go ahead.
According to their delusions, they call black as white. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. If you want to conform to the ancient way, please observe the sages of the former time.
Thank you. So when we're caught in the delusion that our existence is substantial and separate, we call black white. He's saying we get it backwards. We cannot see that we exist within a matrix of interconnectedness. We feel isolated. But when we see deeply into the jewel mirror of samadhi, those three poisons I mentioned, greed, hatred, and delusion, are transformed into medicine. Poison can be transformed into medicine to heal ourselves and the world. So greed, grasping on, when it's released from our kind of self-clinging, transforms into compassion and caring. Take the self-interest out of greed, and it actually becomes caring. Aversion, released from self-clinging, turns into what's called discriminating wisdom. Discriminating wisdom. So we see clearly what's needed, and we can respond with the self, the distortion of the self-clinging released. And then delusion. Usually delusion we think of as turning away from. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see the truth. So delusion without that self-clinging or self-protectedness turns into a clear-seeing equanimity. So each of these poisons with the self-clinging dropping away actually becomes healing medicine. And when our conditioned habit patterns drop away, even when we let go of them a little bit, you know, it's hard to just drop them all at once, but though sometimes we do, we open up this bright, clear light of awareness that can shine clearly on everything equally, just like the white egret in the moonlight from early on in the poem. It's the third pair. It says, filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight, although I prefer to call it a white egret. This is the ancient way, the way of the sages of old. Now, the first week I asked you, when you were in small groups, I asked you to consider how seeing into this jewel mirror of samadhi relieves everyday suffering. And to encourage you to think of an example from your daily life. And that might have been a bit much to ask the first week. But maybe you're starting to see how that might be so, how that could be so. It's not something you can rationally think your way into. Or if you do, it will only take you so far. But I think these ancient words and images from this poem and from some of our other texts that we chant together and read have a way of kind of planting seeds that we kind of incubate or gestate as a whole. Not a conscious rational. And those seeds kind of open, sprout in us. And it might be when we're sitting on the zafu, but more than likely it'll be in our daily life when something just shifts and our view is open. Sometimes it's called the whole sky turning. Sometimes when we're least expecting it. But our sitting, our practice kind of primes the pump or nurtures that seed down in us. So we continue. We continue on our pilgrimage as these old Zen masters did through life. Maintaining our practice, it's nothing special. As the great Zen master Zhaozhou said, ordinary mind is the way. So it's the daily stuff of our lives that actually helps us turn the whole sky. So I will stop here. And I will ask you to take a moment, maybe take a piece of paper and a pen if you don't have one yet. Let's pass these around again. Take a piece of paper and a pen. And maybe just make a note to yourself of some moment in your life, it could be today or at least recently, that you could say, you experience the moment as just this is it. Just experiencing that moment that was somehow, in some way, vividly present for you. What was that like? You could make it into a haiku poem if you like, because haiku are actually short little Japanese poems that depict just one of those just this moments, just this is it moments. But don't worry, don't feel like you have to write a poem. Just see what comes up for you. Take a few moments.